PRN.FM, your station for progressive viewpoints on politics, economics, health, the environment, and a whole lot more. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And we're going to be talking with Dr. Pepper Schwartz, a friend and colleague and brilliant woman, about her new book, The Normal Bar, The Surprising Secrets of Happy Couples, and what they reveal about creating a new normal in your relationship. Hello, Dr. Pepper Schwartz.
Hi.
It's so good to have you here.
What?
It's. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I did. I had a little trouble hearing that last thing, but I got you now.
Okay, good, good. This is a wonderful book, and your publisher sent it to me, and I had a lot of fun reading it, even in Hawaii on vacation. So.
Oh, gosh. That is a high compliment.
Yes. And there's so much in this book that is really, really valuable. I think it'd be very interesting for the listening audience to hear how this book came about, because you're one of three authors.
Right. Well, it's really an atypical story for me. It really is. Normally I think of my own ideas, and I tend to do solo books, or I pick a co-author, but I get this call out of the blue from Chris Ann Northrup, whose name sounds like Christine Northrup, the very famous doctor. So my ears perked up, and she called me, and she said she had this great idea about trying to understand what's normal in happy relationships, and told me a little bit about her own background and how she needed this information to fix her relationship, which she did. And she said, and I was looking for a co-author, an academic who would be able to study this with me, and I did my due diligence, I pick you. And normally, I don't think I would say, you know, tell me more. I'd be busy, and I'd say, that sounds interesting, but I'm not your girl, or whatever. But this time, it just caught my ear, and I thought, this is an interesting way to think about something, and it's not the way I would have thought about it, so all the more reason for me to find out more. So I said, well, I'm interested. You know, that's interesting, but we'd need a demographer or pollster to do this, because I don't want to be the person who does the data collection. And she says, well, okay. And then I don't hear from her for a while, and then she comes back like a golden retriever. You throw a stick to her and says, okay, I got one. So it's Jim Witte, who's a Harvard-trained demographer, great guy, and I'm thinking, wow, I guess she's really serious. And then I said, well, but you know, it's going to need an agent. She said, okay. Getting an agent's really hard. But
yes,
she comes
yes.
back, you know, just like before, you know, got an agent, got a great one, which she did, Helen Zimmerman. And so basically everything that I asked her to do just to get this project in place, she did. And then she turned out to be this very interesting, very creative person. And so this thing gathered steam. We got the Reader's Digest to float a small questionnaire on their cyberspace to see if people were interested in this approach. And we got 24,000 people to answer a 10-question questionnaire in, you know, probably less than 2 weeks. And I thought, okay, that tells us something. And so we then managed to go to 5 different cyberspace Internet sites, AOL, Huffington Post, Reader's Digest, AARP, and iVillage. And then we did about 10 of those in different countries, China, France, Germany, Hungary, Australia, Spain, you know, about 10 different countries, translated the questionnaire, which at this point was now 17 pods of 10 questions each on different parts of relationships, and ended up with more than, I guess now, 80,000 people who've taken the questions. And in fact, you can still go. Your readers can go to thenormalbar.com and do the questionnaire. It's still up there.
And they can learn a lot, and it can get them thinking and communicating better.
I think so.
Yes. Your book, The Normal Bar, is divided into Part 1, Part 2, Part 3, Getting Together, Part 2, Living Together, Part 3, Staying Together. And since this program is only an hour long, not even quite, we're going to just focus in on a few of these areas. And I think that starting with a little romance, or you say, or a lot. Because a lot of people, how do you define romance? And you probably got lots of answers. I know you did from reading the book. But I think one of the most profound things that is how important is romance. You state that couples who stop spending romantic time together often lose sexual interest in each other, and we call this romantic deprivation. And, of course, I see it all the time in my couples counseling.
Boy, I bet you do, because what happens is people forget how to connect at that physical and chemical level. They, you know, it's like, it's almost like anything, right? What I tell people is if you stop using your left arm for, you know, 3 or 4 years, you wouldn't expect it to work well, and it wouldn't. And it's the same way with your heart and your emotions. You have to stoke them up. You have to feed them. You have to make them feel that this is a habit that you consciously do in your relationship because of the profound importance of its presence and the profound importance of its neglect. So I think what happens is people get on automatic pilot. They stop saying I love you, they stop greeting each other at the door, they stop holding hands, all of which turn out to be extremely important.
Very important. And the surprising thing that you uncovered here was that apparently men suffer more than women when they perceive a romantic deficit. And that goes really against the stereotype.
It does, and I think it's the stereotype is just wrong. Now, it may be that men aren't as talented in delivering romance in the way that some women would like it.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean that they don't want it or they don't feel it or they don't need it. We not only asked, you know, how many people felt deprived of romance, and there were more men that said they did than women, but also, is this something that really bothers you? We wanted to get a sense of intensity, and then it was double the amount of men who were really bothered versus women. So I think women may not be reciprocating or may turn off or just, you know, are insensitive because the guy doesn't seem to perform romance for them in the way they would like it, and so they think he doesn't need it, but he does. He does, and a lot of men were bothered by it.
And apparently, and this has been my observation over the years, the longer a man stays long-term, the more in touch he is with his emotion. His emotional side, and so he may become more romantic as he ages. And the Kinsey Institute did a survey of about 1,000 middle-aged couples who'd been together at least 25 years. And I don't know if you looked at this survey. This is another survey, but it backs up your findings that men want more physical affection. And not so much more sex, although your survey showed they definitely want more sex, but they want more intimacy with kissing, cuddling, caressing, not necessarily sexual caressing. And so people hear this, and then they have to be more willing, I think, to accept the stereotype of male promiscuity and the inability to commit, because they actually do want more physical intimacy and caressing.
Yeah, they do, and I'm not sure where this this stereotype started. I suppose because of, you know, again, the different ways, and, you know, if people have read the love languages, the different languages of love.
Yeah.
And I think that's been a very popular book because it gives people this insight that, you know, you may be getting love from somebody, but not in the way that you recognize it as such, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's going on here. These men, yeah, they want more sex. So do women, although men are twice as likely to say they want more sex than women are. But we really need the cuddling, the I love yous, the massages, the touching, the thing that says you're important to me, the thing that is kind of a balm that we all need to quiet all the kinds of things we run into in everyday life. And if somebody's feeling unloved, they'll either retreat or they'll go elsewhere, neither of which are good.
One of the brilliant aspects of this book is that after looking at the data, you have really good tips at the end of each chapter. And one of the things that you say is start kissing more, because a lot of passionate kissing goes away. What are the statistics on that you discovered?
Well, what's really upsetting is that it goes down as people stay together. In other words,
yes.
you could predict how much kissing's going on by how long they've been together. And somewhere around 6 to 9 years, not that long in, it starts going down. And so when you start out with like 80% of people doing it when they're young in the relationship or young, to have people of over 55 or more than 21 years of relationship, less than half of people kiss passionately anymore. Well, I think it's like 45%. I mean, that's so fixable. It's so important. And if you sit there and you read this book and you think, you know, and I always think the couple should read them together, you know, we don't kiss passionately as often as we used to, or even just spontaneous kissing, you know, just making sure that we're connecting that way. Let's try and do it a little bit more. Let's give a kiss, you know, a really nice kiss when we greet each other when you come home, or before we go to bed, or in the morning before we go to work, and just some simple thing like that. And I thank you for complimenting us. We tried very hard to do really important, very simple exercises that, you know, don't include, they don't mean you have to go to a therapist, although on some things that are bad, of course you do. But in things like this, you could do so much repair with so little just by thinking, you know, we still love each other. We're not kissing as much, but we could. So why don't we? Let's try.
You know, I give a homework assignment to some of my couples where I ask them at the end of the day when they're greeting each other to kiss for 7 seconds and hug for 15 seconds. And then they can go on and transition from the work into being at home and in a more relaxed way. But it sets the tone for the evening if they greet each other with a kiss, a good kiss and a good hug. And because kissing is one of the least threatening and most exciting ways to vary your intimacy. And you put tool 9, let's bring back the make-out session. Yeah, make-out. Make out on the couch. Remember when we were teenagers?
Yes,
kissing was almost a religious experience, and the make out in the car. I'm sure you can remember that.
Oh, with great fondness.
Yeah. And you were supposed to keep your hands above the waist.
Well, and occasionally you did.
And occasionally you did. Exactly. I should tell people that you are the author. Usually you just have one co-author or you write it alone. But is it 16 books now?
The Normal Bar is my 17th book. I have a romantic travel book coming out that will be my 18th, and I have two more I'm working on. It's kind of weird. I mean, it just shows you live a long time. Whatever you do, you end up doing a lot of it.
Yeah, and your memoir, which we discussed on this program a couple of years ago, Prime,
right,
was just great. And that one you definitely wrote alone because it was... what was the subtitle of Prime again?
Let's see.
Yeah.
I think Love, Sex, and the Sensual Years. So
yes.
It was
and
about, you know, when I had left my marriage of many years and went back out on the dating scene and... You know, sort of rediscover yourself as a woman, as a partner, and as somebody who has to sort of, you know, kind of shine up all those skills that you haven't quite looked at in the same way in a long-term marriage. And, you know, there's just various stages of your life, and they used to be sort of orderly, but now they're not. You never know which stage you're going to be in, couple, single, whatever.
Well, you're so prolific and such a good writer. Just I'm very much in awe of you. And I don't have to be gushy about it, and I won't be, but I am, and I'm thrilled that you could be my guest today.
Okay.
And people really can use this book very effectively because you can, it's an easy read. I've underlined much of it, but it can be a way to start a conversation with your mate. And communication is really, really important. And using the normal bar, what do you suggest about that, using some of the data as a conversation starter?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. When we ask people what was the most important thing that they needed more of, we thought it might be sex, we thought it might be romance, but actually number one was communication.
Mm-hmm.
Couples don't feel they're communicating well enough. And so we thought this book would be a great way for couples to read through it. This is not a book that's heavily imbalanced for women over men or vice versa. We try to be, and I think from our feedback, we have treated people fairly evenly, you know, by gender. But we think it's a very positive book. It talks a lot about all those strengths people have. You know, we really focus in on extremely happy couples. So a lot of it's about what's making these extremely happy couples happy, and then we have some suggestions if you feel like your normal is not the same as these happy couples' normals, where you might want to improve it or where you can congratulate yourselves. But at the very least, and you've pinpointed, as of course you always do, get sort of the core thing that people really should think about, which is the fact is that it's really great for a relationship to talk about this stuff, you know, to look at these statistics and feel good about some of them, or take a bit, well, do you feel that way about that, you know, and, you know, do you ever feel like I'm criticizing you too much because we talk about, you know, that part of communication too, or do you feel like you would like me to kiss you more, hold hands more, or say I love you more? Or, I mean, you know, it's amazing. Even if you've been in a 25-year relationship, sometimes you actually really don't know the answers to that question. And it's set up not to criticize, but to say, let's talk about it. Let's find out how we're doing and what we need to say to each other that will make our relationship better, that will make us more intimate and more able to take care of each other. It's presuming that people want to do that.
One of the things that I've noticed is that many couples feel that a partner, a husband, a wife, should just know what to do, so there's no need to talk about it when it comes to sex. And you discovered, I mean, of course, in the process, there are so many often misunderstandings and cross signals and hurt feelings. And so I find that as a sex therapist, I sometimes have to help them learn practical sexual communication skills that fit with their sensibilities. And you're actually alluding to that, fitting with people's sensibilities. But the data you found is that men want from their partners more sexual diversity. That would be new sexual acts, less specificity, more passion, and more sexual noises, feedback.
Yeah, they want to get some feedback.
Yeah. And there can actually be an advantage in making more noises and feedback in that it puts more oxygen in your body, and that can raise the arousal.
Yeah, so, I hadn't thought about that. That's quite right.
Yeah, it's like I even encourage women who have trouble reaching orgasm to letting their partner know, fake it till they make it. So make more sounds, and then that can turn them on more. Women want from their partners more foreplay, more romance. That would be loving passion. Foreplay is more touching, of course, and less predictability, more spontaneous and fun. And the foreplay business, one of the more common complaints I hear from women in my practice is he doesn't engage in much foreplay. And of course, men become ready typically much faster than women, both physically and emotionally. So when sexually experienced adult women were asked, they replied they need at least 17 minutes of foreplay. And then she should be the one to signal when it's time for penetration.
Well, I wouldn't want to try even guess about how many men actually put 17 minutes of foreplay in. Of course, a great lover really does. It's not even considered foreplay. It's part of the sensuality of making love, of touching and exploring and seeing mounting excitement. I think a lot of women are entered before they're really ready, and I think a lot of guys sort of like, you know, use their fingers as a dipstick and sort of think like, oh, she's ready. That doesn't work so well with postmenopausal women, but
no.
It used to work, you know.
Mm-hmm. That. Mm-hmm.
But really, if a woman's lubricating one way or the other, it just means it's possible. It means she's excited. It may not mean she's really excited enough. And I there was a psychologist long ago, I heard this phrase from him, I don't know if he met it, if he made it up, but it was Terry Tafoya, and he once said that the reason that many women fake orgasm is because most men fake foreplay.
I really like that. I think that's one of the jokes that's in your book.
It is. It is. And it's a joke, but it's kind of real, which is
it is kind of real.
You know, I mean, we need more stroking, touching, arousal. You know, even I think a woman really, most women really enjoy and want intercourse with if they're in a heterosexual relationship, and sometimes in a lesbian relationship they like penetration.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that it takes a while, particularly as women get older, to get to the level of heat, you know, and having the blood, you know, sort of rush to the right parts of the anatomy, so that, you know, I think what women, when they put foreplay in there, they're saying, you know, more of that. They may love what they've got, but they'd like more.
And there's something else that happens. Some women will complain of pain with intercourse.
Yes.
And what happens is when the woman is aroused enough, the entrance to her vagina thickens, the top part of it tense out, and here's the important thing. If she has a uterus, it lifts up and away from behind the cervix. And if that hasn't happened and she's not aroused enough, the penis can actually hit the cervix and then the uterus if it hasn't lifted up and away. So that can create pain.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, and I think when people are talking about pain,
mm-hmm.
You know, I would say let's look at the easy explanations first, like, what if we took more time to be excited? What if we used a more lubrication or a different kind? What if we took care and found out which positions worked? You know, there may be something bigger going on, but I'd look at the easy-to-fix stuff first.
Absolutely. It's and that's another really beautiful thing about this book, is there it's a lot of tips for stuff that's easy to fix, as you mentioned a little bit earlier. I really like, having spent some time in Italy many years ago when I was in my 20s, I think you did too, didn't you?
Some. More in France than Italy, but
yeah.
Hey, I'll take you to one.
But anyway, the Italians come out pretty well in your surveys. Who's having the most sex? 62% of couples in Italy had sex several times a week. And also, Italian men are known to be the most passionate kissers, according to your survey.
Well, it's true. It's true. But I must say that, in fact, the French, the Italian, the Spanish, they generally line up together. Those
mm-hmm.
Latin countries figured out a lot that the Anglo-Saxon culture, you know, is still trying to figure out. And that's,
yes.
You know, lots of kissing, lots of romance, lots of body contact. More, you know, it was interesting to look at the French, the Italians, and the Spanish in terms of public displays of affection.
Mm-hmm.
We think they go, again, you know, being touching each other, holding hands, kissing. Americans tend to go, oh, it's like bad taste, or get a room, or something like
mm-hmm.
that. But in the extremely happy couples, they're much more likely to do public displays of affection. And there's just much more of that, you know, in these Latin countries than in our own. I think we're inhibited in a way that we think it's good taste not to show public displays of affection. I think it is good taste. It shows that those people are in love, connected, and feeling affectionate. That's what we ought to applaud, not making sure that we don't look like we've ever held hands in our life.
And holding hands can really be so sweet and fun, and a lot of couples stop doing it.
I know.
You know, just to go back to you make some really good points about in Latin countries, there's much more PDAs, public displays of affection. I read some time ago that Italian men will actually talk to other Italian men about what really pleases a woman. And not in a macho bragging way, but they actually share information. Did you ever come across that in your readings?
You know, I have, but I can't remember where. I think the fact is, if you look at making love in the same way you would look at your golf game, you know, that is to say, okay, yes, I can play golf, but, you know, I'm going to take lessons on my petting, my putting. I'm going to take lessons, you know, on my long ball. I mean, all that kind of thing. Nobody would think it was bad to take lessons to be better at your sport. People who love a sport are constantly trying to up their game. Well, you know, I don't think that many people think about sexuality that way, but they could. They could say, I'm going to study my partner's body. I'm going to see what really turns her on or turns him on. I'm going to ask. I'm going to see if I'm doing it exactly right. I'm going to be like a scientist or someone who's bettering their game because, you know, not only is there always more to learn in terms of what, you know, your partner may want to explore with you, but also as you get older and life changes, you know, what you want kind of changes. Your body's responses changes. So if you're just doing the same thing you've done forever, it might not be effective anymore, even if it used to be.
Exactly right. So the way around that is to talk, to communicate. And again, your book, The Normal Bar, is so useful to help couples communicate. What happens here is at half past the hour, we go to a few minutes break. And so we're coming up to that. Let's talk in the few minutes that we have about a little bit more about keeping the sexual flame alive, which is your chapter 11. I really liked that chapter a lot. And there's a... You have fill in the sentence, fill in the, in your advice, you have, my partner could be a better lover if, and using, yes, I think, well, you have surprise night, and certainly more spontaneity is important. And I really like tool number 44. Set a night once a month to try something in bed that you've never done and haven't done in a long time. It could be as simple as making love on the floor instead of the bed. Now, some of us are older and we maybe don't want to do it on the floor. But putting perfume on in unusual places, wearing something that you would generally not wear, or wearing nothing at all. The last part, you had some very interesting findings, and this is something that you can immediately do to have better sex, and that is sleep in the nude. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, people who sleep in the nude have more sex. That's just all there is to it. And, you know, it may be that there's more of a hint that way, like, you know, you could feel if your partner was getting interested, or just that the body contact, you know, when you wake up or turn over in your sleep or whatever, when there's a nude body next to you is arousing. But there's definitely more sex going on, and I think it tells your partner that, you know, we're connected that way. I want my skin against your skin. So it's an easy thing to do, you know.
Yeah.
Or just take off your top or your bottom or whatever, you know, if you feel like the whole deal would be just too much at once. But I think it's a really good sensual thing, and it puts the right philosophy in the bed. I mean, maybe if you're cold, you know, wear your tops or your bottoms. But the idea is to have that flesh against flesh sense of, this is who we are together. This is an important part of who we are together.
Some happy couples probably often go to sleep spooning.
Oh, yeah, because it's just a wonderful, cuddly way to go. And even if, you know, you kind of like need to spread out and not be attached after you fall asleep, you can spoon a while and then separate, you know, to be more comfortable if that's what you need. But, this body contact, I think, is another way of communicating to each other that, you know, we're connected this way. It's another type of bond that's expressed in this particular way. And, if you don't, it's not like you have to go to bed nude all the time. Maybe you just do it occasionally, or surprise your partner that way, or surprise your partner that you're putting on something silky instead of, you know, the T-shirt you normally wear. It's
so Pepper, there comes the music. So let's continue this after the break, and we'll be back in just a few minutes, and we'll have a more conversation with Dr. Pepper Schwartz. So please stay with us. We're back. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And I'm talking with Dr. Pepper Schwartz. Her book, The Normal Bar, The Surprising Secrets of Happy Couples, and what they reveal about creating a new normal in your relationship. It's a wonderful book, and it can do so much for the relationship. You have a chapter, Let's Get Physical, Maybe Even Kinky. The kinky, 50 Shades of Grey, is really up to people's interest. Of course, I think you probably took a lot of this data even before 50 Shades of Grey.
We did. We were very surprised, you know.
Yeah.
I think we have, I think the exact statistic, but it was about
86% of people are intrigued by the prospect of having kinky sex. That's quite high.
Yeah, it was something like 78% of women and 94% of men.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's very high. It means, you know, that there's a lot of unexpressed desires, because we don't have those kind of numbers of people doing things that are a little bit, you know, daring. I think it's just kind of the kind of thing where people actually want the same thing and they don't say it to each other, and so nothing happens.
Yeah, nothing happens.
They're afraid that the other person would think badly of them, even if it's a long-term couple.
It's very surprising. I find that when I get a new couple in terms of marriage counseling, or that they really haven't really talked to each other. They haven't really said what they want. And it's really too bad. Because, as you say, if they haven't expressed it, they're probably not going to get it.
You know, even to talk about, you know, maybe something they had that they would love the other person to consider, but they're too embarrassed, even in these very close relationships. Which I think is one reason people could take the normal bar and talk about that. Like, okay, maybe we won't tell our deepest, darkest fantasies, but let's talk about a few. You know, let's find out what your take is on it. You know, like, I had a fantasy about, you know, let's say I'm making this up, but, you know, I kind of had a fantasy about being tied up, and it was sexy. And the other person could say, well, you know, I can't even see the sex appeal in that. And they could say, you know, would you like to try that? Would you like to see if that was sexy? And if it isn't, we stop. And if it is, we can do some role play or something. And I mean, you'd be amazed, people, if they just opened the door a little bit, they'd find out what they're both comfortable with, and if there was something that they could do. It could be even as little as, you know, I would like to be blindfolded and not know where you're going to touch me next. And a person could say, wow, you know, I'm happy to do that with you.
And as far as being tied up, one doesn't even have to use a rope. The woman could, for instance, put her hands above her head and cross them, and pretend that she is tied up, and then or the man, and then performance anxiety is eliminated because she or he is rendered sort of passive. Anyway, sex acts. You have in your book, what makes one person more adventurous in the bedroom than another? And, Pepper, I'd really like for you to expand on this. The answer is a complex mix of experience, culture, and self-esteem.
Well, you know, experience is, you learn your own sexuality, and people with more experience usually have a wider palette, you know, to choose from. They've tried things, decide what they like or don't. Culture mm-hmm. makes a really important thing. Did you grow up in a house that said sex was bad, or did you grow up in a place where you were allowed some freedom, or that your religion didn't say everything outside of marriage is a sin, or, you know, that you were gay, and, you know, maybe in some religions, and most religions, that used to be looked down on or seen as sinful or even seen as worthy of punishment. Maybe you were in a progressive household that said that was good, and you were growing up, and that was your sexual orientation. I mean, you know, the experience you have, the culture you come from, all of these kinds of things make a huge difference.
And one reason I think that some older couples start having, and David Snarch talks about this, that you may have the best sex of your life in your 50s and 60s, and I think one reason is that women become more assertive. They can more easily talk about what they need and want, and they know what they need and want from more experience. And men can slow down and be a little more romantic. So it can work very well in the bedroom.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, yeah. It's one of those things that couples, they stop acting like they think they're supposed to act. And they start talking about what they really like or what they, you know, don't like so much anymore. Just the fact of feeling secure enough to talk and to learn and to change however the direction you're going in. I think when you have goodwill, you become wiser together about each other and who you are. And so, yes, you know, the aging process has many drawbacks, but oddly enough, sexuality can become richer.
You have, indeed, and it's so, isn't it lovely to be discovering it personally, too?
Yes, exactly.
I know. You have in this chapter, let's get physical, maybe even kinky, get kinky with it, watching a sex video. And actually, in 2 weeks, Candida Royale will be my guest. And we've been friends a long time. And I, as long ago as 1991, when I was in Amsterdam at one of the World Congresses for Sexology, she lectured and she said, if a couple is not watching one of my films by the end, I think I've been very successful. And, of course, she makes films. They are explicit, but they have a plot. They have music. They're really for couples to watch, and females are paid very good attention to. And starting in 1984, she was really the first female producer, director, writer on the scene.
Really? That's
yeah, and she had been a porn star before that. But she really had a vision that was 1984. That was about the time that the people didn't have to, well, videos were coming out, and people didn't have to go to a dirty old theater to watch pornography. And you say in the book, or you can also watch these films or go to goodvibrations.com, and they have movie reviews there.
They do. That helps a lot. First, Good Vibes is no longer only owned by a women's collective. It's been sold, but it started that way. And there's a feminist feel to it, so that, you know, they take a look and they say, you know, how would a woman feel watching these kinds of films? And some, they say, are good for women. As others, they think are more, you know, particularly, let's say, the male taste or gay male taste or whatever. But they give you enough information so you could sort of feel like, you know, what would turn me on as opposed to turn me off. I think that's a lot of reason women don't do it, because they think it might be in a situation, you know, some of those classic old-type films where it was all about the man and it wasn't about a woman's sensibilities. But, you know, I agree. I think most of these movies are kind of a turn-on immediately, and, you know, you don't, it's not like you get immersed in the plot, so it's like you don't have to finish the darn thing. But, you know, for an adventure for a couple, I mean, it would be interesting to see if you liked it or you didn't like it, or you liked the idea of it, but this wasn't the right movie, or nope, that's not your thing. But I'd say, hey, if you trust each other, this is the perfect moment to explore and find out.
I actually loan out some of her films to some of my couples, and then we talk about it when they come back.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, and it can be very revealing. I even have a rating sheet with different feelings on it. Did you feel happy, angry?
Generally agree or not?
Most couples, I find most couples do like it. Sometimes men will say, well, it wasn't quite racy enough for me, but the nice trade-off is he's got his partner there watching with him, and they usually do get turned on.
Yeah.
So it can jumpstart sex.
I think it's nice, too, every now and then to surprise yourself or surprise your partner with something like that. We talk a lot about that in the normal bar, that surprise, you know, mm-hmm. again, from, you know, wearing something different to bed to thinking of a new romantic way to go away and have a great getaway. I'm a big fan of a day or a couple days away. Or some little new thing like being willing to watch a movie that's explicit, or saying new things to each other. I think those little surprises keep a relationship vibrant.
Absolutely. And surprise is a huge element of romance, isn't it?
Yeah, we talk a lot about that in the romance chapter because, you know, what is it, you know, if you come into a room and there's 20 votive candles lit that you didn't expect.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get both the effect of candlelight, which is always, almost always romantic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you also get the surprise, so you're grateful that somebody took a little bit of time to surprise you and to make you, you know, your whole system gets elevated that way. It doesn't take much. I mean, maybe it's coming home with, you know, a rose, you know, that the other person didn't expect, or a surprise trip to a romantic restaurant, or a picnic in the living room. I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, huge, grand, expensive. It just needs to be thoughtful and intimate.
And your data shows that men are really equally or even more needy for expressions of romance than women.
It is true. The men really, I think maybe a lot of women get caught up, you know, in child raising, which is,
mm-hmm.
you know, they often get the brunt of that, or domestic duties, they often get the brunt of that. And, you know, that might tap down their romance feelings. And so mm-hmm. I often think to men, you know, you want more romance, do the dishes, take the dog to the vet, you know, whatever it is that makes your partner realize that you're trying to take care of her that way. And then she might be a little more romantic back.
Yes. And you also say something very important in your book. Too many of us show love in the way we'd like to receive it without taking into account our partner's needs and preferences. So get out of yourself and think about your partner.
And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, it sounds so simple, but it's really not so common where,
mm-hmm.
you know, you think about not what I would want for romance. I
mm-hmm.
maybe what he wants is to get in bed early and you know, have cuddling and romance, et cetera. But what would she want? Well, maybe she would want, you know, some really intimate conversation over a glass of wine first.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
yes.
that's not, you know what I mean? And if you think,
yes.
okay, that step will get us both in the same place that, you know, I want to start at, but that step's necessary.
You have in your chapter on called Unfaithful, this was amazing to me. 71% of men and 49% of women said they fell into and acted on sexual temptation due to sexual boredom. Sexual boredom is huge among couples.
It is. It is because, you know, people start saying, God, I'd like to have something like I miss it so much, you know, someone acting like they were passionately interested in me, someone, you know, throwing me against a wall in passion or mm-hmm. or digging their fingers into my back or whatever it is that used to happen when there was this intense need. And, you know, you can't manufacture that all the time in a long-term relationship. But every now and then, if you do something that shows passion and sets the scene for some interesting sexual time. I mean, it might be taking a bath together and you know, soaping each other's body up. I mean, I'm not necessarily talking about something huge, but just so that this little differentiation, this passion, is at least sometime injected into the relationship, because, you know, people start to long for something that stirs them, and you don't want that to get going.
And then dopamine gets produced, and dopamine needs novelty. So if you switch up things a little bit, maybe play out a fantasy and make love on the floor, as you suggested in the book, or do something new and different, then you're likely to produce more dopamine, which gives you more arousal.
Yeah, you don't want... I remember Sting, the very famous singer, talking about his sex life with his partner. And, you know, here's a man who's a very sexy guy, and he could have, I'm sure, anybody he wanted to, but he extolled his wife because they have a very active, imaginative sex life. And I think, boy, you know, if it can satisfy somebody who could have the world, you know, then we could also put out some effort to satisfy each other in, you know, less glamorous lives.
You know, that's a very good point. And then doesn't he also write songs about it?
Oh, yeah, he writes songs about it, songs about her.
Yeah.
I mean, he loves his wife, and I think it's because she can meet him halfway on passion.
Yes, yes. The Pursuit of Relationship Happiness, your final chapter. And I love, you really got somebody very good to make your graphs and to make cartoons, and so we get a little humor. But what is the most important element to your happiness? These are some pretty interesting statistics, because at the top of the list is the relationship with 54% of females and 56% of males put the relationship as number one for their happiness.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to think about how much both men and women only function well when their relationship functions well. That if their partner is not happy, or if the relationship is in trouble in some way, they can't be happy. I mean, we ask them about these other categories, about, you know, their mother or father, their extended family, their career, money, their religion, health, children. None of those ever got, I think, above 12%, you know, in terms of how many people said that was the most important. And that was only children. I mean, I think...
That's right. Children for women was 12%, and for men, 9%.
Yeah. I mean, so these are all little statistics that fill up to 100%. But the vast majority hung their happiness around the health and warmth and satisfying nature or not of their relationship. So I think it's really important. In fact, there was a study, I don't think we say it in the book, that came out, and it looked at in terms of, you know, overall health.
Mm-hmm.
They said that the relationship was a more explanatory variable in terms of how predicting people's health than obesity, smoking, high cholesterol. It went through all these terrible things, but it also said the relationship was more important to the overall health than even those threatening things.
And that's amazing. And furthermore, remaining sexual as you age is very good for your health.
That's true.
And if you're making love vigorously, you get some aerobic exercise, you get just doused with orgasm, you get so much more oxytocin and endorphins, and and then that sense of connectedness, I mean, it's very, very good for your health, and you're less likely to be depressed.
Well, it's true, and that's true for your relationship, and your relationship supports you in everything else. It's all this, you know, we're all connected. It's not like you can box off your intimate part of your life, or you can box off your sexual part of your life. It's all part of the same body, same brain, same system, same nerve connections. We have to keep that part of our life healthy to be healthy.
Yes, yes. Toward the end of your book, and we're, by the way, Pepper, we do stop about 2 to 3 minutes before the top of the hour, because
sure.
That's what the instructions that I get from Progressive Radio Network. normalizing the new normal. If your partner does something you really like, say, I want that to be our new normal. That's great. That's really great. And it changes it all around, too, because some therapists really don't like it when people say, well, what's normal?
We're not using normal like 98.6. We're using normal like how do you normally run your life and what normal do you want?
Yeah.
There's no 98.6, but there's no normal that you have to pick. There's no normal that's uniformly better for one person than another. But you do want your normal, the way you interact, your daily life, the way you do your housework, the way you handle arguments, et cetera. You want that normal to be pleasing, and if it's not, why not pick a new normal?
Pick a new normal, exactly. One of the things we haven't discussed yet in this hour is the frequency of sex, because a lot of couples want to know how often other people are doing it, particularly if they're having sex very infrequently, which is, anyway, what you found, do you recall that statistic, 2 to 3 times a week, I think, for...
Well, you mean it varies by age, right?
Yeah, by
but
age.
Our extremely happy couples, we're having sex a lot, 3 to 4 times a week. And obviously, if you look at those extremely happy couples when they're older, it's going to be less. But the idea was that a high frequency of sex, you know, you don't know what's the tail and what's the dog. Obviously, people who make love that often are probably pretty darn happy with each other. But I also think it works the other way, that people who have a lot of sex, it's one of the things that reinforces their happiness. So it's not just that happy people have sex, but sex makes people happy.
Oh, yeah. It makes people very happy, and they feel better connected, more, when they have physical intimacy, it really makes the emotional intimacy deeper, and it's sort of a positive feedback loop.
Yeah, I think people shouldn't think, sometimes they think that sex is something that's additive but not necessary, but we did have, you know, about a quarter of our couples who didn't have much sex were happy anyhow. So it's not impossible. There's all kinds of reasons why people might not have sex a lot, including, you know, various kinds of physical disabilities, but 3/4 of people who were happy were having good sex life. So it's more the anomaly to be happy, and even if you're not having sex, than it is to be happy and having sex. Most people, 3/4 of people who are extremely happy are having extremely good sex lives.
Yes, and you talked about older people maybe not having as much sex. Of course, it requires a good amount of health. And you talked about disabilities, but in general, women of all ages tend to have body anxieties and men performance anxieties. And both really do rob you of the inability to lose yourself completely in the lovemaking, which can be really important to good sex.
When we want you to get in there and help them.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, you know, our couples who are inhibited, you know, they're stuck, and they need help to go to someone like you and help them cross the divide. We look a lot at extremely happy couples, and one of the things we found is that, you know, they have their own fragilities too, and being able to go to a therapist like yourself about sexuality, communication, intimacy, whatever it is often a sooner than later idea that really works. I'm all for encouraging people to get help.
And you do, and you have sent me people, and I appreciate that very much. And I just get, as you get, so much satisfaction out of your work. And then because you write so well and have had so many books, you really help a lot of people through your books. And one of the books I have you put out quite a while ago was The Sex Weekend, I think it's called.
Oh, The Great... we have a new version. It's called The Great Sex Weekend. It's the getaway guide to a great sex weekend. Help and couples be a little more inventive.
Good. Well, thank you, Dr. Pepper Schwartz, so much. This has been a fascinating discussion. The normal bar. I recommend it to you highly. And also you can go to Pepper's website, drpepperschwartz.com.
You bet.
Yeah, thanks, Pepper, so much.
Thank you, Diana.
Bye-bye now.